discuss with this court pending petition 20-05. Judge Roos, please proceed.
Okay, Judge Roos, and I thought you both were going to be presenting, but I take it that you are going to be the main presenter. So Judge Roos, please begin.
That is correct, Madam Chief Justice, and if it pleases the court, and I thank the other members of the court for listening to this rules petition. I'm not here in my capacity as a member of the Court of Appeals, but as Attorney Gleiser noted, as a member of the Judicial Council, and in particular as chairperson of its Appellate Procedure Committee. I'm actually relatively new to the council, appearing first about this time last year, and new to this project, which actually goes back to 2016, and includes at least a dozen drafts of the rule, and reflects a great deal of work, research and deliberation, and the collection of interested parties' opinions regarding the rule petition. And while I was not involved with the lion's share of the work on this petition, the committee has kept its records of its work, thanks to Chief Staff Attorney Jenny Andrews, which materials I've reviewed in preparation for today. So there are a lot of individuals that went into this project, more so than me, but I do want to specifically thank Jenny Andrews, who's done a yeoman's work on this project from its beginning and has significantly assisted me in shepherding it through. Today, I will provide a summary of the history leading up to this petition. I will summarize some of its provisions, emphasizing a few of them, and of course, welcome questions from members of the court at any time and certainly after my presentation. In terms of the prompting for the project, much of it is summarized in the accompanying memorandum to the petition. I'm not going to repeat it too much, but suffice it to say, the Court of Appeals, our Court of Appeals, reached out and asked if something could be done to enhance the current version of 80985, which is what the rules petition focuses on. The current version is terse. In total, it states, an attorney appointed by a lower court in a case proceeding appeal to the court, that should mean either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, shall continue to act in the same capacity in the court until the court relieves the attorney. And that is fine. It serves a distinct purpose, and it frankly is the genesis of everything that relates to what we're working on here. But it did lead to a patchwork of responses by courts and clerks when confronted with post-trial proceedings, and it seemed to provide little guidance to litigants and attorneys. So the committee sought to adopt a consistent and logical set of procedures that would apply. And early on, it was determined that the new rule would apply to non-criminal cases, with one exception, and that's TPR cases. So TPR cases, criminal appeals under 80930, no merits under 80932, and TPRs, of course, are 809107. They're excluded in large part because they already have their own rules and have for some time regarding these issues regarding substitution of appellate counsel and procedure. So the new provisions were created to enable a certain procedure, one that does not exist now, for the withdrawal and substitution of both appointed but mostly retained counsel in appeals, and principally the rule deals with civil appeals. It clarifies for litigants and attorneys how to proceed. It specifies how to provide the proper notice that the case law has required, and when necessary, a court determination as to whether to allow substitution or withdrawal of counsel. Or conversely, it enables the clerks of the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court to self-execute certain substitutions of counsel without a court order when appropriate, thereby increasing efficiency. I will submit the provisions are consistent with existing case law of the state. There was research done in that regard, although I wouldn't stand here and say that there's a wealth of published case law on changes regarding appellate counsel, but there is some and we reviewed it. The provisions are largely, if not entirely, consistent with the practices of our appellate clerks, staff attorneys, and judges, again, whose input we received and carefully considered. And where there have been concerns in the past dealing with particular issues that arise out of change of counsels on appeal, the new language provides, we think, reasonable and efficient solutions and procedures. Importantly, I want to stress that the changes that we propose are completely consistent with relevant Wisconsin Supreme Court rules. I will submit they also essentially compile those rules within one written location for the benefit of attorneys and litigants. And I think the language here, which again is consistent with those rules, will help ensure their adherence. And in particular, although not exclusively, I know SCR 20:1.16, it's C, not E. There was a typo on the first page of the memo. I apologize for that. Try as we might, we still fail. And SCR 11.023. A further note before I get into the general contours, and I'm going to be brief in that regard. The rule was designed and will kick in, for lack of a better phrase, to protect clients, including those of all types and levels of legal sophistication, from any colloquial drop balls while the search for replacement counsel proceeds. One area in which this comes up that is of keen interest to us is where an attorney has been appointed pro bono to represent an indigent person, again, in a civil proceeding, for example. And after the trial or relevant proceedings, the pro bono counsel wishes to withdraw for any number of reasons, some of which might be just that they're comfortable as a trial attorney, but not an appellate attorney. And so that would be an occasion in which this would come up. We do believe that the rule changes are designed to best satisfy the interests of attorneys, both those wishing to leave representation and those wishing to engage a counsel on appeal. And as alluded to, I think it best protects the interests and best practices of our courts and our staff. With that, I will just briefly go through the contours of the changes and the important provisions. I will not go through and discuss every provision in the proposed rule. I'm happy to discuss any provision. The thought processes that led to the final version were summarized in the memo, and I refer to that in conjunction with my comments here. Just to begin, we do note that the prior little old version of 809.85 remains as subsection one. Its fundamental purpose remains. But suffice it to say, and consistent with the goals and considerations I mentioned before, the provisions do address a number of particular subjects. First, pro hac vice admissions. And of note, we have included language that we believe is consistent with current practice and has good policy reasons behind it, which is to inform pro hac vice attorney about the need for Wisconsin counsel to sign filings. And we can discuss that more if the court wishes. Two, we address limited appearances under the new 802.045. We address substitution of counsel, both with or without client consent, and also among members of the same legal entity as existing counsel, to be, again, efficient in that regard and to also be clear in that regard. Probably of greatest interest is the section regarding withdrawal of counsel, again, with or without client consent. We're very happy with the procedures we've come up with. We enumerate various notice requirements that have the function of not only providing notice to the client involved, but also facilitates the petitioning counsel to provide appellate courts with sufficient factual information to make a decision, because as we all know, we're not finders of fact, but the notion being that the submission would require all of the relevant facts that would be needed for the court to consider it. And of course, it does allow notice to the client to respond to the motion for withdrawal and the time period in which to do that. And that those considerations could be taken in. A list of non-exclusive factors for the court to consider that are consistent again with case law, both regarding national court cases we reviewed and also kind of the practices in our circuit courts. It does establish a procedure for the referral of an indigent criminal defendant who might be losing retained counsel. It does so consistent with pre-existing rules. And based on the discussions, we believe it will rarely apply. It really would only come up in the rare case where there was a criminal defendant had retained counsel at the trial court level and then seeks to have new counsel at the appellate level, but also would qualify as being indigent and therefore possibly receiving public defender support. Typically, those individuals have public defender support at the trial level already. But we wanted to keep a provision in there that would potentially deal with that rare scenario. The withdrawal of counsel section also includes an important tolling provision, subsection G. It ensures that the tolling of the time required for any act while the attorney withdrawal motion is filed and pending occurs. There already is a tolling provision in Chapter 809, but there is at least some ambiguity as to whether it would apply to a motion for withdrawal of counsel. So we decided that it would be best to just eliminate that ambiguity. It does accept out, of course, the jurisdictional deadline by which to file a petition for review. And that segues nicely to subsection H of the withdrawal of counsel section, which recognizes the current practice of the clerk's office with respect to filed petitions for review, which is to accept them in the matter of course by whomever files them, whether it's a new attorney, party's prior attorney, or even the individual, because of the jurisdictional deadline, thereby obviating the need for any motion or special action. We have a provision regarding the handling of a client's file. There are, of course, ethical rules that deal with this, but it also, and it tracks those rules. And despite the relatively short length of this subsection, a lot of thought went into it, and it might not be reflected in it, but let's just say that the catch-all of unless the court otherwise orders, or orders otherwise, I'm sorry, at the end of it captures and provides flexibility to address unique scenarios. In sum, on behalf of the Wisconsin Judicial Council, we respectfully ask this court to amend WISSTAT Rule 80985 consistent with our petition. We believe the changes are designed to clarify the issues related to attorney pro hac vice admissions, substitution, withdrawal of retained counsel in Wisconsin courts. We submit that the changes will aid practitioners, litigants, and improve our court's efficiency. And while perhaps not dispositive of the bench and bar's view on the merits of these changes, we do note that all comments and concerns during the drafting process were carefully considered and addressed as best as possible. There have been no negative public comments filed in response to the rules petition notice. And of course, as the court knows, the State Bar Board of Governors expressed its unanimous support for the petition. One final thing is I do mention that there is a Judicial Council note that we asked to be adopted. It basically highlights three notions that we thought being warranted being mentioned, but did not warrant being included in the body of the rule itself. There was discussion about whether to incorporate that language into the body of the rule, but we thought the rule as it exists deals with it, but a little commentary to clarify in those three instances was worthy. And we proposed an effective date of July 1st, 2021. Thank you very much for listening to us, to me today, and your consideration. And with that, I'm happy to receive any questions from the court.
Okay, well, thank you, and thank the members of the Judicial Council for working on this really necessary change, I believe, in our rules. I think it's very well thought out. I did have some concerns about the note. But to express our thanks to the members of the Judicial Council. And before I talk about that, more importantly, is what is in the rule. So do my colleagues have questions that they would like to ask and have answered? Well, you must have done a stellar job.
Well, that's one inference from this, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, well, I think you did a very good job. I mean, this is something that I think has been needed for quite a long time. And I think that you covered a lot of ground in a very concise way, which I found very helpful. It also reads well from top to bottom. So if you go looking for something, you aren't going to look too long. I did wonder why you chose the note. Why did you want to put that Judicial Council note in that says what it's not intended to do and what it's consistent with? And why did you put that in?
Sure. And again, I'm relying principally on my review of our meeting minutes and other documentation in which these types of discussions happened before I began. But my reading of those discussions is that various interests, you know, we were dealing with, as it related to, for example, 80930 sub 4, That, of course, is the criminal appeal section. And, you know, individuals at various times brought up comments about, do we need in subsection 5A to cross-reference that? And similar things with Supreme Court Rule 20:1.16d. Mm-hmm. Folks definitely were considered and did not want to do anything to disrupt the applicability and necessity of these other rules, while at the same time, us incorporating language that touched upon those concepts. In some instances, we did include the cross-references in the body because they seemed to make more sense. It would be more enabling. Mm-hmm. But in these particular instances, we thought it was just best to use a judicial counsel note to know that, hey, you don't see it exactly in the rule here, but we're aware of these provisions and we're just augmenting them, essentially. That was the thinking, at least as to the first two. Subsection 6 judicial note, the last sentence of it,
right.
That alludes to what I said earlier, which is the client file section is not overly long, but there was robust discussion about issues related to client files, and in particular, you know, how they overlapped again with the ethical rules. And, in this particular comment came from a concern that admittedly might be rare, but there at least is conceivably the possibility that an inmate would seek to change counsel and request a file. And based upon comments, sometimes, you know, if a client has an ethical obligation to return that file, sometimes that inmate's, you know, a repository, let's just say, becomes a black hole and things get lost and it's messed up. And so there was the notion that we want to give courts flexibility, and that's where the phrase "unless the court orders otherwise," I mean, it covers all types of scenarios, but we want to give courts the flexibility to say if they know that newly appointed counsel is coming on board, they can make sure that the rights of the inmate are adhered to. That is, they have a right to the file, but they might also request a little bit of more additional time for that counsel to get actually appointed, and thereby kicking in the ethical obligations between that interim zone, if that makes sense. So
yeah, that does make sense. Thank you.
Regarding, I can't let you go without asking a question. What a great opportunity.
Yes, I was telling my clerk, I said, I thought my days of appearing before the state Supreme Court were over. But
No. Welcome. It's my recollection that we don't adopt judicial counsel notes, but we have them printed. Do you have any response to that?
I'll be honest with you, I do not. In fact, I might defer to my colleague, Bill, if he has more familiarity. I'm actually not as familiar with that procedure. And if she were here, this would have been one of the many times where I would have turned to Jenny Andrews and say, what about that? But I apologize for my ignorance in that regard.
That's okay. You can ask me.
Okay. Yes, please.
What about that? You know. I think we generally don't adopt the notes, but we print them. There may be exceptions. I don't know if Attorney Gleisner has any specific comment to make about that.
You're muted, Bill. You got to, Attorney Gleisner, take your mute off. Should be down on the bottom of your screen, left-hand side. Got it. Okay.
I think I got it now. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Okay. I think Justice Bradley had it right. My experience has been that in the past, judicial counsel notes, when added, were just printed and not adopted by the court.
Thank you for affirming my opinion.
Judge Roos, thank you for your thorough rendition. In the copy that I have, there are a couple of highlighted portions. I don't know if that came from the commissioner's office or that came from you, but it has to do with Wisconsin counsel signing every document filed in the court.
I think that came from the commissioner's office, I would deduce. It certainly did not come from us.
Okay. And how do you feel about Wisconsin counsel having to sign every document filed in court?
Well, I've given a lot of thought about that because I know this has been a discussion among folks on the e-filing committee or committees, as it were. And my opinion is it's still nice to have the requirement. I know it's the practice in most circuit courts, at least it was when I practiced, which is some time ago now. But and the thinking is this, is that the requirement not just has the benefit of, you know, making sure that there is a Wisconsin attorney presumably has more interest in his or her standing in a Wisconsin court than maybe an attorney from some other state who's here on one case. And therefore will make sure to adhere diligently to all rules of the court and procedure, ethical, and so forth. But my experience has been that even with, you know, we all know there are different levels of local counsel. There are those who work as a team, you know, they're actively involved. There are those who just handle the administrative stuff, you know, for attorneys, and that's fine. But I think even if you're in that latter category, there is something to be said by instituting a reminder to the Wisconsin attorney that they have an ethical obligation to basically oversee their counterpart and have to sign off, you know, whether it be physically or electronically on a submission. And in the course of doing so, they might recognize, you know, I'm not going to impugn other attorneys from other jurisdictions, but my experience is sometimes they don't realize how strict and adherent to certain rules that we as judges and attorneys in Wisconsin are, and that is, you know, will incite the notion that, you know, the Wisconsin attorney could say, look, I know you're making this representation in the brief here, but geez, that's pretty close to stretching the record. There might even be violating our duty of candor. You know, we don't really like that. And, you know, and it, you know, you have that dialogue and it keeps that kind of fail safe there. That would be my response to it. I will say one further thing is that, and we talked about this as a council at our last meeting, if the court is inclined to jettison or not to adhere to that type of requirement going forward, you know, we can amend this rule and adjust accordingly. I do think it would affect a change in kind of standard practice, but it's not the most important part of our rule by any stretch, but we included it because it was our understanding that it was very consistent with common practice, and we do think there is a genuine benefit to it, especially at the time when you're talking about counsel changing, you know, where the new counsel, the pro hoc counsel, is not, you know, maybe as familiar with Wisconsin rules or requirements. And, you know, that's the time when it might be most suspect to have a new attorney from another state just be signing documents, you know, without them even having looked at, for example, 80919 and brief formats and stuff like that. So that long-winded way of answering that, but I hope Justice Kurofsky that went to it at some level.
It did. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Thank you both. And thank you for the work of the Judicial Council. With no further questions on this matter, then we will adjourn the hearing on this rule petition 2005. And you all, of course, are free to leave, as I said, or if you just love Zoom, well, you can just hang out with us. Either way is okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, very good.